didn't wear you out too much. Or maybe it's supposed to. Summer Serve 2014 has been going great. I want to thank all of you who have done all the things that it takes to make it such a success. I'm going to say something that may seem obvious to some, but I think, unfortunately, it's something that's really easy to overlook, and that is the fact that you are making a difference. Isn't it easy to just go through life and do the things we do and forget to stop and think about ways that God can use us and does use us to make a difference in this world? You know, in everything that's going on, the overall planning and organization of Summer Serve, Sue has done a fantastic job, and the team of people that she's working with. And even the projects that we're doing, you know, the church staff didn't sit around and come up with those. We ask you, what needs do you see in the community? And many of you came back to us, you know, Meehy and Beth and Betsy and Karen and Steve and so many other people. I left, you know, Tony is another one. To find these projects, to meet people's needs, to touch people's lives, the people doing the meals, people working in and around our building, volunteers that are working with the kids, you're all making a difference in this world, in our community. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this in a minute, but you know, up in the room with Tiny Stitches, where it's mostly women who are. I think there's one man up there from the organization Tiny Stitches who comes and knits with the group, which is kind of cool. Any men knitters out there? Not so much. Okay. In that room, sewing, they're doing lap blankets and different things. But in that room, we have teenagers through some of the oldest and dearest among us. And I'm going to tell you, in that room, there's more going on than sewing. This intergenerational kind of teamwork that is such an amazing and such a beautiful thing. There's learning going on there, not just about how to work with fabric and yarn. You know, we even had good weather on Wednesday nights, which is pretty cool. I don't know if you remember it all, but this is the fifth year we've done a summer program, and I think it's rained about every Wednesday night, sometimes like serious storms where we had to just shut down and say, everybody go home. I don't know if you recall, but 5 years ago, the Metro Atlanta area region was in a severe drought. Lake Lanier was 23 feet below full pool. And we started scheduling outdoor events on Wednesday nights. Just one more way that we're making a difference. So all we have to say is, Metro Atlanta, you're welcome. No more drought. In Matthew 5, starting at verse 13, it says, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. When I was in college, I had a friend named Greg who loved the outdoors. And he was a good outdoor kind of person, too, because he had this epic beard that was so much better than any beard I could grow. And you know, we all kind of envied that beard. But he liked the outdoors, especially hiking, backpacking, and camping. And for him, the older the better. He would take these week-long backpacking trips, and he loved along the Appalachian Trail, and he would come back with pictures of him and a couple of friends hiking and backpacking through the snow, you know, in the mountains, and he would have icicles hanging off of his epic beard. And I thought that was so cool, and I thought it was also something I would never want to do. But one day, Greg asked me if I wanted to go camping with him, and this was no hardcore icicle on the beard trip. This was Friday after class. We were going to go up to the mountains outside Chattanooga, spend the night, and come back midday Saturday. And, of course, he has all the gear, and I had nothing. Around our house growing up, there was an old sleeping bag and with a broken zipper. And, you know, it was one of those sleeping bags that it's not warm, but it is heavy. And so that's all the sleeping gear I had. And but I asked him, I said, you know, do I need to bring long johns, like thermal underwear? He goes, oh, no, you won't need those. And we went out to the mountain. We, you know, set up tents, and it was really beautiful out there. And there were a lot of really good memories about it, the best one being the smell of bacon the next morning, cooking on a campfire. If there's anything better than the smell of bacon cooking on a campfire, I can't think of what it is now. Maybe a baby's head. But not cooking on a campfire. Come on. Just the smell of fresh humans, you know, they're awesome. But if you're a vegetarian, probably the smell of tofu frying over a campfire is awesome to you. I don't know. But what happened, though, is this was late fall, and we were in the mountains, and it got cold that night. And I was in my cheap, heavy, broken zipper sleeping bag, and it got cold. But the worst part, what added insult to injury, was Greg, you know, the epic bearded master camper who has all the gear, told me I didn't need long johns, and he brought his. And he was toasty warm in his long johns and his good sleeping bag, and I froze the whole night. I woke up at 3 a.m., and I was too cold to go back to sleep, and I was laying there just waiting on the light of morning. And it was so miserable. I couldn't figure out whether to keep my boots on or take my boots off. My feet were just like, they were icicles, you know. And I'll never forget being so happy when, I don't know why I didn't wake everybody up early, but I just laid there. And finally everybody got up between 6 and 6:30. But that 3 or 3.5 hours of just laying there longing for the light of morning, it's one of the longest nights of my life. And but that, you know, you may have a memory of longing for something like that. There's an emptiness to it. There's a kind of suffering that goes on when you want something and it just doesn't seem like it's ever going to get there. I was longing for the light of morning, but in this passage, Jesus says that this world is longing for a different kind of light. And they're experiencing a different kind of cold. What this world is experiencing is no hope. A world without hope where it seems like nobody cares. A world filled with hatred and prejudice and exclusion. A world of loneliness. A world of hunger. A world of injustice. A world of slavery. A world of slavery to sin. crushing financial stress, a world of broken relationships. It's a world that, whether it knows it or not, is longing for God. It's a world that's longing for light. And Jesus says, okay, I have a solution for this world that's longing for light. And of course, as believers in Jesus, we believe ultimately he's the answer. But Jesus is talking about something a little bit different right here. And he says, you are the light of the world. Who? Who's the light of the world? His followers. Who's the light of the world? Kind of nobodies. That's who he was preaching to here. Kind of nobody in particular. The people who just believe they were created to live a life in which they strove to bring about God's will being done on earth the way it is in the heavens. It says, you are the light of the world. As we think about putting Jesus' teachings into practice, living out God's will being done on earth. Another way to say that is living under the reign of God, or the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven. There's a couple of pitfalls that I think we need to do our best to avoid. And the first one I want to talk about today is we can fall into the mindset, unfortunately, sometimes, in thinking about putting Jesus' teachings into practice as just a list of things that we can do in order to make God happy. Or a list of things that we can do to make God happy with us. Or maybe even a list of things we can do so that God won't be mad at us anymore. Anybody besides me kind of grow up with that mindset? I don't know a whole lot about God, but I'm pretty sure he's not happy with me. So if I can just do enough good things, it might at least take the edge off of that anger. Whole different sermon about where that might have come from, but Jesus' teachings are not a list of things to do to make God feel good or feel better about us. You know, sometimes I think we can think about putting Jesus' teachings into practice as being too hard. And usually what we're imagining is when people imagine Jesus' teachings as too hard, they're imagining themselves doing all these things as the same people they were when they first encountered the teachings, with the same mindset and with the same identity. When Jesus is preaching this sermon, what we call the Sermon on the Mount, he started with identity. You know, our theme for this year is known, and we're talking a lot about what we're known for, who we're known as, and the fact that we are known by God, that we're fully known and fully loved. But Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Jesus gives a vision of what the world could be like if people put his teachings into practice. You know, I've talked a minute ago about we live in a world that where so many have no hope. You know, what is it like when somebody unexpectedly treats you with grace and kindness. When somebody unexpectedly treats you with justice or with compassion. I was talking to Paul Peeler yesterday, and he was telling me about a man that they had hired to do some work in doing an estate sale for them. And this man found something in the house that was of much greater value than they knew. And rather than, this man totally could have taken it and just put it in his truck and never said a word, but he brought it to me, and he told Paul, "You don't want to sell this. This was made in 1938 in Germany, and it's an original. Take this and put it aside." He could have taken advantage, but he didn't. And he gave me a few other examples of the way that this man dealt. Now, if you're ever in a situation where it's possible for someone to take advantage of you, what do you expect? That they will. That's the world we live in. If somebody can get over on us, they absolutely will. That's the way we're conditioned to think. What happens when, out of the blue, unexpectedly, somebody treats you with compassion or justice or fairness? That's a good day. It's a good day. And it goes beyond just that little event. You know, I've been having some struggles with a car that I bought for Austin recently. Ended up having to put a new engine in it. And I won't go into the whole story because I don't like to cry up here. But I had the car at a shop, and they pulled the head, and they did all kinds of all kinds of work on it, and we decided, through the mercy of some close friends that I won't name, so you won't go to them and ask them to help you with the same thing. I decided, you know, I couldn't afford the $4,000 that it was going to cost to fix the car, so I went and got the car and brought it back and put the engine in with the help of good friends who actually know what they're doing. But I had to call the shop and say, "I'm not giving you the job. So just put it back together, and I'm going to come and get it and write an invoice for whatever I owe you. I know you guys, you've done a lot of work. So I'll come and pick it up and charge me what you think is fair." I talked to them, and they said, "Just take the car. We're not charging you anything. If you want the name of the shop, you know, talk to me afterwards." Because we think that's one of the greatest fears in taking your car to a shop or hiring a plumber anything that you want to do is that when people are in a position to take advantage of you, they will. And what happens when they don't? What happens when they treat you with grace? What happens when they treat you with compassion? What happens when people seem to care when they don't have a reason? It's not in their best interest, or you're not family. What happens when people care and they reach out? And they touch your life by serving you in some way, meeting some need that you can't meet yourself. It opens up your eyes to the possibilities of a different world. There are some people, when they have that kind of interaction, maybe for the first time, it opens their minds to the possibility that there's a God. And Jesus is saying, you know, I have a vision for that kind of world. And you know what? Your role in that is, you are my lights. You individually, but you collectively. You shine the light of possibility on a dark world. You show people that it doesn't have to be the way it normally is. But it starts with identity. Jesus doesn't say, "Listen, if you want to make me happy, go do this, 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 and this." Jesus says, "I have a vision for the way the world could be. And you are my lights. You're my ambassadors. You're the ones who get to show the world what it would look like for God's will to be done on earth the way it is in the heavens." We need to remember that anytime we start falling into the mindset of putting Jesus' teachings into practice being a list of things we do to make God happy. But I think another pitfall, I've already mentioned it earlier, but we underestimate the impact of doing the works of the kingdom. They can seem so small. They seem insignificant to us sometimes. But we need to see them as what they are. They are signs of a different kind of world. They are signs of the reign of God that will be complete one day. But we're involved in helping the kingdom of God to break in on this dark world. We have a friend named Amy who came to Summer Serve last Wednesday. And she's a woman that we met through Orange, through the Rethink group. And she's written a book on how churches can help to build faith and to support and care for special needs children, you know, for the long haul. And she's an incredible woman, and she and Sue hit it off right away, but she wanted to come. When she heard about what you were doing, she wanted to come and see it. And she got to meet a number of you, and she loved it here. But she sent Sue an email and said some really amazing things about you. One of the things she said, I left your church last night in tears, and the first thing I did was call my mom and tell her that I had just experienced church like I hadn't in years and years and years. She particularly talked about the sewing room and about having teens all the way through senior ladies working together, and about what was going on in that room. She's a part of a local mega church, and she told Sue, she said, "You know what? That just doesn't happen in a mega church. It just doesn't happen." She said, "You are a family." She said, "I couldn't help but be struck by the looks on all the faces. These people love being together." Easy to forget how special you are? Isn't it easy not to notice how remarkable the things that you're a part of are? But you are. Jesus said, "The greatest among you will be your servant." And he said, "You are the salt of the earth. You're the light of the world." By doing these works of the kingdom, we demonstrate that we believe in God. some endless cycle here, that we are going somewhere, and it will only be brought about by God's power in God's time, but we're participating in it now. Through the things that we do, the things that God invites us to join Him in doing, God's future breaks in on the present. What we do always flows from who we are. It's not a to-do list. It's living into our identity as people, as followers of Jesus, as salt of the earth, as lights of the world, as people who partner with God to show the world that a different world